There was only one high and difficult hurdle that had to be got over before his new thrifty life could truly begin. It had been at the back of his mind in Spain, shouting to be heard. But since he'd been in London, it had grown like a government subcommittee. Lawrence had this overwhelming urge to tell somebody, anybody, every detail of what had happened. If he lived in a normal place, he would perhaps be able to discuss it with those who had been there. But in Spain, there was something called El Pacto del Olvido, literally, the Pact of Forgetting. It was an unspoken and collective decision taken after the death of Generalissimo Franco. The only way Spain could survive the end of fascism without succumbing to savage retribution, as had happened in so many other countries, was by a tacit communal agreement never to talk about the awful incidents that had taken place. The foreign community in his village over-enthusiastically adopted all things Spanish, so they too had taken on their own Pacto del Olvido, which over the years had come to encompass a lengthy list of things which they could never discuss. The events Lawrence had the irresistible compulsion to talk about were currently at the top of that list. Lawrence supposed this need to unburden himself was connected with him being out of the valley for the first time since it happened. After all, it was something many travellers did. Liberated from home and among strangers whom they had no chance of seeing again, people were often overcome with an irresistible desire to tell another person their darkest secrets. Over the years, Lawrence had had men and women in airport lounges, hotel bars and train stations relate to him the most intimate and disturbing confidences. How they were in love with their sister. How they binged on jam. How they'd sold nuclear material to Chechen separatists. Now he wanted to do the same thing. But the problem was he didn't have any idea who to talk to. Whoever he confided in needed to accept certain far-fetched things as being true. If he didn't choose carefully, there was the danger that some stranger might pretend to accept the things as being true, just to humour him, but really think that he was deluded. That wouldn't be nearly good enough. He was certain he'd pick up if they were humouring him, and then he wouldn't get the sense of release he so desperately craved. Right at the moment he was thinking all this, Lawrence noticed the man standing in the middle of the pavement not 20 metres away. Poised as if he'd been placed there by one of those interventionist deities people prayed to, an all-powerful life form who cared whether or not they passed their cookery exam. Lawrence knew at once that here was somebody who he could easily tell his whole story to. This man would regard as true everything that the average stranger in the bus station waiting room would think were the ravings of a delusional psychotic. "So you say you have a story you wish to tell me?" the young man asked. "Yes, indeed," Lawrence replied. "Many have a story they need to get off their chests, and I'm here to listen. Don't be afraid. There's nothing I haven't heard before." "We'll see about that, you pompous little prick," Lawrence thought to himself.
Alexei Sale, who you've just heard reading, made such a lasting impression with his mix of knockabout surrealism and ferocious left-wing politics, essentially inventing alternative comedy in the early 1980s, that for anyone who hasn't been paying attention, it comes as a bit of a surprise to register that he's been dedicated more or less full time to writing fiction for a decade now. Mr. Roberts, which you've just heard him reading from, is his fifth book of fiction. So we're pretty overdue to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
I've been standing outside for the last 10 years waiting.
I wonder, writing comedy and writing fiction seem like very different ways of working, and yet you're all at it. I mean, every comedian now seems to be writing fiction, no doubt. I mean, much worse than you. Well, that's the wrong way of putting it. You're much better than them. But why do you think so many comedians have taken to novels?
Partly it's, it's just an expansion of the franchise. The comedians are by inclination, they're Alexander the Great. You know, they want to conquer all lands, really. So they, because they're all like Alexander the Great, terrible narcissists. So they just anything that's offered to them, they will attempt, really. And the public buys enough of them to make it commercially viable. I think they've kind of slipped away a bit from writing fiction, because I think that's too much like hard work, really. Although there still are a few, but of course now it's the heart-wrenching autobiography that they're now really all piling into. And I am. I have actually been commissioned to write a line, but I'm usually pretty good at kind of missing the trend, and so I will. Mine will come out just at precisely the moment when everybody's sick of that.
But I wonder with novels, it does. It's a very different way of writing, I would imagine, because you can't. One of the surefire way of killing a novel is to tell it as a string of gags, isn't it?
Oh, indeed, and you have to. You know, you do have to take the jokes out, because actually, I think that is something that I've. That is something that I've refined in terms of my my own technique. And I know my wife was very keen to get me to take a lot of jokes out of Mr. Roberts. At one point, it was more jokey, and they do very much disrupt the narrative. You know, they suddenly jerk you into out of the story and into another world. You know, it's always my inclination to put them in, and I have to then put them in and then take them out.
This must be a bit of a wrench.
But then that's, you know, I mean, all that process. I mean, that process of writing, I mean, particularly novels, is about that, really, you know, killing your own children. You know, I mean, just always that process of taking out the bits that particularly tickle you. But obviously, yeah, right. I mean, I had always tried to write prose fiction. I never really had an authorial voice until about 10 years ago, when I would have been...
Oh, right, you know, but you've been doing it all along.
I tried to. I'd made an attempt, you know, and some of the stories I'd written, I tried, you know, like maybe 5 or 10 years before to write them, and they were just very prissy, really. There was no muscularity to the way they were written. And then suddenly, when I thought of the idea for Barcelona Places, my first short story, and sat down again to write it, a very spare style had emerged from somewhere.
Did you have models for the kind of writing?
Not particularly. I mean, I tend to go along with that sort of, you know, I mean, shibboleth of Evelyn Waugh, that don't just show us what happens, don't describe the... Although I don't entirely follow that. I mean, I think I tend to try and show what happens rather than describe the internal thoughts of characters to a great extent. And I don't think I do a lot of dialogue either.
And is war a sort of touchstone as the kind of the novelist you'd like to be, or the sort of novels you'd like to write?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think that I'm not a great one for hero worship or for, you know, for following other people, but it seems to me. I mean, one of the things I like about war is similarly that I'm not supposed to like him, really, you know, because he's so reactionary, and you know, he hated the working class. There are no working class characters in any of his fiction, really,
apart from the odd little two-dimensional
servant or this trimmer in the sort of honor, who's a, you know, pretty despicable character. I like that he could see how ludicrous he was, really. I mean, he appears kind of as various people, I think, in his own fiction, and always as pretty despicable people, but he can really get, you know, and I like that kind of disappointed romantic in him, you know, the turn to drink and, you know, whatever. And I just think he's just terribly funny. And he also, I mean, he was lucky in that, I imagine reading, I mean, particularly the early satires in the 30s, that nobody had ever done that before, you know, and also, you know, he tackles, there's incest in there and, you know, just sex and homosexuality and politics and, you know, the ludicrousness of politics. It's all amazing stuff. Nobody had ever done that before.
He's pretty fearless, isn't he?
Yeah.
With this book, there's a lot of strange things that go on in it. But in a lot of ways, it's also just a very closely observed portrait of British expatriates living in Spain. Is that a life you know well? It reads like something that would have to have been grown out of fairly close observation.
Yeah, no, I've got a house in Spain in a village which isn't that village, but is, you know, bears some similarities. I mean, I live in my house is in a valley, and what I've done, the village that I've, my imaginary village, I've sort of pushed it right to the end of the valley and sort of put a wall around it, you know, so it's more isolated. But yeah, now it's
and
it's
a very eccentric bunch you populated with. Is that the story in where you have a house?
It is, really. I mean, I don't want to. I suppose, I just, you know, having having made my peace with the people of Liverpool, probably southern Spain is somewhere I can't go back to now, but it'd be interesting to see if my house has been daubed with graffiti. I don't want to, while highlighting their absurdity, this is in no way, it's a kind of paean to those people in some ways, because they lead very vivid lives, I think, and there is, in a way that I don't think they would do in the UK.
They're sort of cut loose from the sort of normal restrictions on their behaviour.
Even time, in the sense that the bar, that everything's moved later by 2 or 3 hours in Spain. So they'll go for, they'll be drinking in the bar till, midnight, and then go to a club or something in the nearest town. And these are people who are retired civil servants from Huddersfield. It's kind of amazing.
So it is a story that draws quite heavily on reality, but then the aliens arrive. How does that happen? Can you tell us a bit?
Yeah, well, I don't like to be constrained by any genre, and I just wanted the initial idea I had was actually for Mr. Roberts the Alien, and I had this idea of a kind of a suit that aliens use to explore various planets. So each one, they have one for each planet, really. So if it's a, kind of octopus creature, they have one of those. And the alien, which is about the size of a 13-year-old boy, can sit inside it and explore the planet. And through a deserter from a battleship lands on Earth with the Earth alien suit, which is this big kind of 6-foot-odd man. He dies, and a 13-year-old boy, finds him, basically. And that was the initial idea, and then after that I just had that idea for years, and I was looking for a place to locate him where the story, the story would have greater resonance than just some kind of sub-Terminator kind of idea.
And having a suit that he can get into and immediately gain superhuman strength from transforms the life of the very timid teenager who finds it, and that of his mother, who's a rather lost figure who hasn't really sort of picked up the pieces since becoming a teenage mother, and she's still full of resentment about having a child at 16, where it's led her. And it becomes a kind of parable about power, doesn't it?
It's about power, and it's about identity, really. It's about who you are, who the boy is, because he's both himself and Mr. Roberts. It's about, the Brits in Spain is who they are, because they're suddenly against, they're taken out of their own environment and put against this other backdrop. Yeah, and it's about power and how you can remain yourself, I suppose, and use power.
It's also about very much about how power mesmerizes other people, isn't it?
Yes, and I hadn't thought of that. It's only when I start doing these things that I find out what they're about, really. So
that's what your novel's about.
Yes,
Alexi.
Thank you. yes, it's about. You do sometimes. You think that about. It's funny. I went to the House of Commons, I think this. How was it earlier this year? And just sat, in the visitors' galleries, whatever it's called, and looked at the politicians, and they're weird, really, because they're like show. I know somebody said politics is, show business for ugly people. And sort of it is, really, because you look at these people who are, if you're interested in politics, Jack Straw or, David Miliband or, William Hagen. They are people who are intensely familiar, like actors or comedians, but without any talent, just power. And it's kind of weird because they're both vapid and kind of charismatic at the same time, really. It's very, and that again is the, it's only their job that gives them any kind of luminescence at all, really, I think. And it's a kind of odd thing, and we defer to power in a way that I'm very uncomfortable with, I think.